Greetings. Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, where we talk about stuff that matters. We're mixing up the format a little bit. I'm still hosting while Sihlen Gubesi is away, Big Daddy Liberty. Shout out, my man. This time, I'm joined with Gareth van Onselen. How's it, Gareth?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Gareth, our viewers, I'm sure, will all know, is our primo expert poll and survey go-to man. And he is, a pretty extraordinary writer. And a lot of what I want to talk about today is a piece that Gareth wrote for the Business Day earlier this week. I think in that piece, Gareth kind of drills down to something quite profound and quite substantial about the state of the nation in a sense that is political, and also in a sense that gets sort of past, I think, just the corridors of power and into our living rooms and into our minds. So, Gareth, one of the concepts that you play with there is the learning curve or the unlearning curve. I think for viewers who haven't read that piece, and even for those who had, can you just unpack that a little bit and explain the idea and explain what it means in the South African context?
Yeah, look, well, that idea is actually quite far down into the column, and it flows from a number of other things. Mm. So what I've tried to do basically in that piece is take a bigger picture analysis of South Africa. I think it's something that we're quite bad at doing in South Africa. We tend to analyze stuff on a kind of day-to-day basis, and if you're lucky, a week or a month. Mm. But if you take a step back and you look at the country and society more broadly, there are obviously broader patterns of behavior and trends that define the national disposition and mood. And I think one of these is our attitude towards patriotism and the kind of things that flow from that, things like whether we're optimistic or pessimistic. If you go all the way back to when the ANC was at its sort of hegemonic best, its strongest, in about 2004, when Mbeki was president, they had almost 70% at the polls, and almost this kind of ubiquitous hegemonic hold over society. Everyone was united more or less behind the ANC. The media, civil society didn't exist in the kind of vibrant form we experienced it under Zuma. The opposition was relatively small and ineffectual. This idea that the ANC was the people and was South Africa had all comers in its hold. Jacob Zuma disrupted all of that and in fact inverted this kind of patriotic sentiment, where he came to embody everything that was not South African, and to oppose him was the patriotic thing to do, and to oppose Zuma's ANC was the patriotic thing to do.
Yeah. I remember people sort of with South African flags painted on their faces and literally draped in the flag like a cape, marching down the streets in Joburg and Pretoria and Cape Town.
Yes.
Zuma Must Fall, that was kind of the new national anthem.
Yes, and you saw that mirrored in, I mean, civil society is a great illustration of this kind of thing. It was very deferential and non-existent under Mbeki, for example. Under Zuma, it exploded into life with 1,000 different organizations, some of which actually explicitly evoke patriotism, like Save South Africa.
Yeah.
Exactly the kind of enthusiasm that was out there, and it was an inversion of the ANC's usual narrative. Now, there are benefits to this kind of thing. There's a benefit to not seeing the ANC as, absolutely synonymous with the South African spirit and the South African people, and to take a more pessimistic view of it. It forces you to be skeptical. It forces you to question its motives, to question its action, its decisions, its leaders, and that's the kind of attitude you want in society. And I think we learned a lot under that period. The argument in this piece is that is now unraveling somewhat. Mm. We seem to be returning to this kind of patriotic fever under Cyril Ramaphosa. He's evoked as a kind of Mandela-like figure, and he himself is regularly drawing on those kind of ideas of patriotism in South Africa. And it's not fully set yet. I think it's just beginning to happen, but we are starting to forget and unlearn all the lessons that we learnt under Jacob Zuma, to stop being critical. Civil society is shrinking. The media is falling back in line with Cyril Ramaphosa. And it's to our detriment as a society, because we stop questioning those in power. And that obviously leads to a whole range of other problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth remembering that the Tumamina campaign, Ramaphosa found this beautiful old song, but the Tumamina means send me, and he's made it very clear that the person who's doing the sending, the person sending the email, is Nelson Mandela. And on his birthday, his 100th birthday last year, I think in Kunu, I'm probably not saying that right, I'm sorry, he sort of evoked this, and he said, you know, I'm sure that Nelson Mandela's dream is what we're carrying out here, and he made explicit reference to expropriation without compensation, even in that regard. Which was quite hard to square. But there is, just in terms of that, I think there was this sense that while Mandela was alive, Mbeki was his chosen successor. Mbeki couldn't say that Mandela's ghost is telling me what to do, because there was the real Mandela, who could always stand up and say, I disagree. And Zuma couldn't really do that either, because most of the time, although Mandela was quite withdrawn, he was, while he was still alive, it was hard to draw on him in that kind of way. And then he passes away, and you get a new president. And Ramaphosa gets that opportunity, I think, to draw on Nelson Mandela as a figure that a lot of people have very positive attitudes towards, and sort of use the halo effect. Say that halo covers over me as well, and continues to cover the ANC. And I think Mandela is sort of one instance of like a great patriotic symbol. And then you've got the broader sort of alignment of, if you believe in South Africa, then you must believe in me.
Yes, and I mean, this idea of patriotism and the Rainbow Nation and the new South Africa and all the various iterations of that sentiment are very powerful in South African politics. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the DA has you know, put a lot of effort into trying to represent itself as the true custodian of Mandela's values. Because this idea resonates so powerfully in South Africa, and because we are an inherently optimistic, patriotic nation that is actually quite deferential before power and authority, these kind of ideas take on a disproportionate amount of influence in society. And the person or the party that can be seen as the true keeper of the flame is very powerful. And it's interesting to watch this battle, because I don't think anyone's actually got the Keeper of the Flame title at the moment.
Yeah, although it's still up for grabs.
Yes, although I would say it is consolidating behind Ramaphosa slowly. It is a contested terrain, everyone fighting to be the most patriotic and the most committed to this idea of a new South Africa.
Okay, I want to throw in just like some weird historical context. I was going through some historical literature about 19th century media, 19th century press. Oliver McDonough, great, I think, British historian, who was looking at Victorian media, and there were a couple of Americans looking at a similar thing sort of in America from the 20s, 30s through to the 70s and 80s. And they both found the same kind of pattern. Something bad happens, there's outrage, the press kind of jumps on it, then it kind of goes away. Another instance happens, the press jumps on it, there's huge outrage, and then politicians see an opportunity to stand up and say, look, we're going to address this issue. Children being forced into the coal mines to pluck with their little fingers whatever goodies they need to get, women sort of being used as mules to pull the coal carts, things exploding, factories being terrible. And then eventually, as time goes by, the lesson gets learnt, and the media kind of force the politicians into line, and they implement sort of genuine bureaucratic solutions to the problems. They set up inspectors that go around and make sure that these kinds of things aren't happening. And eventually, you know, after a generation, they just don't happen anymore, really. So it's kind of, you know, a good news story. Like, sometimes it can work. Sometimes the lesson can stick when the media maintains its skepticism. In particular, you know, when politicians say, after the first round or the second round of outrage, politicians say, we're going to deal with this issue. There's a temptation to then say, okay, that's enough. But if the media maintains its skepticism, then they can force the they can humiliate the politicians who say they're going to do it and who don't actually do anything about it, to be replaced or to change their line to do something about it. I think that's a story about how sometimes in some places the lesson can be learned. But here the lesson hasn't been learned. And so I've got a twofold question for you. Firstly, what are the particular lessons? Do you have some sort of concrete exemplars of things that we were critical of under Zuma increasingly, and that now those problems are getting masked by the flag, masked by loyalty to the ANC? And why do you think it is that we're so ready to forget and so ready to believe?
Right. Look, for me, the primary problem with the media's attitude to the ANC is basically a crime of omission. I think that when the ANC was at its worst, its most fractured and disparate, and you know, different factions were at each other's throats every day, it forced the media to analyze the party as an institution. To look at its mechanisms, to look at how decisions were arrived at internally, to try and understand the different factional interests and who was in ascendancy and who wasn't. When a party is more consolidated, and I'm not saying the ANC is there yet, but I think this is the trend and the pattern for it to become more consolidated, less infighting, less division, and also having come off the back of an election, which is a kind of informal and formal, you know, bestowing of power, legitimacy on a party. They stop focusing on the internal organizational culture, the ideology, the worldview that informs this organization, and start focusing on outcomes. I think the media has been very good across the board at focusing on things like corruption. I don't think there have been any ups or downs in that. I think it's been consistently very good, and it's one of its strengths. But I think when it comes to understanding political parties, it is very bad at that kind of thing across the board, not just with regards to the ANC. People tend to focus on individual personalities as opposed to ideas being the thing that brings people together or divides them, and the effect of organizational culture on the way people think. So what happens now as the ANC starts to consolidate again is that the media stops being critical of the party, of the ideas that underpin its positions, or scrutinizing them. You don't have to be critical, just you have to understand them and explain them to people, and starts just reporting outcomes. The president's decided to do this, or government's taken this decision, or this person's been appointed, instead of bringing all the pieces together in some kind of consolidated fashion. I mean, one of the things, a good actual practical exemplar that you asked for is, and this is just an inclination on my part, we'll have to see if it proves true, is one of the things you saw the media do a lot of under Jacob Zuma were timelines. They would often print in the paper timelines of events. There were a whole lot of scandals, some quite complex.
Yeah.
And the media would pour great resources into explaining the narrative over time to you.
And graphically.
Yeah. And I think you'll find those things start to evaporate now because we're starting to live in the moment again.
Yeah, you don't want to connect the dots because if you just look at one moment, there can be this frisson of ambiguity. But if you connect the dots and you see the trend lines, that's when patterns emerge that might be harder to support.
Yes.
And that's in fact, I think there's a quote that that I'd like to read out from your piece. You said, you wrote, "Every ambiguity is framed as a sign of potential positive change, not on its merits, but on its indistinctive nature. No one is in jail, but corruption is being taken seriously. The measure is not the outcome, it's the process. Intent becomes delivery, and sentiment transforms into evidence for it." I think that captures some of what you're saying here, is that there's this sense of living in the moment and grasping onto the ambiguities of the moment.
Yes.
And forsaking the bigger picture, the trend lines.
Yes, ambiguous current events, in other words, decisions or statements or policies that are made which are quite hard to determine on face value or in the moment how they're going to play out or where they fit into some bigger narrative, are a great test of a society's disposition. Under Jacob Zuma, he never got the benefit of doubt for anything that was ambiguous. It was framed in a bigger context as part of a whole lot of other problems and interpreted within that context. When you stop being pessimistic or skeptical or doubtful about your those people in power, ambiguities start to get the benefit of the doubt. And they do that because you've lost the bigger context, so they're only interpreted as to what they are, and inevitably, because they're ambiguous, they have some positive attributes. That becomes emphasized in for the sake of national good and positivity and progress and tuma mina or whatever it is. And so that, you know, that also serves to undermine skepticism and doubt and questioning of authority.
I wonder about that, though, because I was not in South Africa when Jacob Zuma was elected in 2009. But I try to keep track a little bit of the mood. And one of the things that heartened me is that there was, you know, at least from a distance, it seemed like some of the pieces that I was able to read on the internet were quite positive. In terms of benefit of the doubt, I remember because you drew, well, I read it in some of the work that you'd done last year. Peter Bruce was giving Zuma the benefit of the doubt during the campaign. He was saying the Stop Corruption, Stop Zuma campaign of the Democratic Alliance was, you should give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe there's a hint of some nefarious negative attitudes here. Maybe there's some Afro-pessimism here. Maybe there's even some racism in play here in criticizing Zuma. But I did have the impression that this was maybe just some branches of the media until I looked at some survey data, and I can't remember who had done these surveys, but it looked like around the time that Zuma was elected, the sense of positivity about both the country and about positivity about the ANC and about him were quite high. And then over time, I think quite quickly, they dropped down. So I think maybe for a time he got the benefit of the doubt, and maybe, and then as you say, it became really no benefit of the doubt. The patriotic thing to do is criticize him at every turn and go into the streets and organize in civil society against him. Do you think that that movie, do you think we're in a sequel of that movie where there's an ANC succession battle, it's very tense, people aren't sure what the outcome is going to be, and then somehow the party manages to hold together, somehow we manage to have a peaceful election with credible voting results, and that gives us some encouragement, and that kind of, and then some wizardry, some marketing wizardry comes into play, and there's this great euphoric attitude, but that a euphoric attitude that can't possibly last? Or do you think we're in a different situation?
No, I think that's a very good analysis. Because, you know, sentiment, optimism or pessimism or patriotism or whatever it is, works a lot like, you know, water. There's a huge bulk of force behind Jacob Zuma when he's elected in 2004 based on 10 years of ANC dominance that washes into his administration, and he carries some of that for a time, and then it dissipates and reverses. In the other direction, I think this pessimism and discontent with the ANC is going to wash into Ramaphosa's presidency. The thing about moments or epochs of intense optimism and patriotism, they are very, very hard to artificially engender. You can sometimes do them, you know, have a Barack Obama-like moment where a whole lot of people sense something fundamental has changed or perceive something fundamental has changed and rally behind it in new numbers. But it's quite hard to achieve it in workmanlike fashion. So I'm not sure whether this will all translate into the kind of atmosphere that we saw under Zuma. But the key point is that I think the attitude with regards to power will be the same. So whether or not people feel on a daily basis more optimistic or patriotic, we can see, we can test this stuff over the next 5 years. But I do think there is going to be the accompanying deference before power and the ANC's, you know, hegemonic hold on society. I think that is something that will now happen because people will once again feel the ANC is more secure, more stable, and it is the natural home for most voters in South Africa, and then that resonates into the other parts of society.
Yeah, I want to read another quote in that regard. The thing is, none of the fundamentals have changed. Sorry, this is another quote from the piece. The thing is, none of the fundamentals have changed, only the mood. But you dare not point that out. And that's why this particular brand of fair weather patriotism makes people stupid. They are looking at essentially the same information. They just feel entirely different about it. They feel different because they don't so much create myths as imbibe them. And they are drunk on the ANC. And I think that's, I mean, I think you've put it very sharply there. And it, this strikes me as correct. The fundamentals, GDP numbers, budget deficit, debt levels, our ability to service our debt, employment numbers, education. There's, it's hard to find a kind of a tangible, concrete exemplar of the new dawn. Mm. And I remember in the build-up to the election, there were a couple of Rama fans who were trying their best to give real examples of what the change has been, and it was really grasping at straws. And yet the mood is so substantially different. And I think something that stands out in your analysis, something that I really don't see almost anyone else doing, maybe anyone else doing, is taking the problem beyond our political representatives and to us as South Africans. I think there's something strikingly unusual, and I don't think it's too much to say, sort of courageous and brave about not just criticizing our politicians, but also criticizing us.
Oh, I'm a big I'm a big fan of that point. I think there's far too little pressure put on voters to explain themselves. I mean, these audit outcomes that have just come out, 18 municipalities out of 280-odd with clean audits, is nothing new.
Yeah.
And 100% of municipalities in the Free State require intervention, according to the Auditor General. The situation was no different in 2012 or 2008. These are circumstances that Free State voters seem more or less happy to live in perpetuity. Mm. And absolutely, you know, politicians must be held to account and we must aspire for excellent public representatives and a high quality of governance and delivery. But at the end of the day, if they exist in an environment that doesn't force them to account in any meaningful way, then you only get what you asked for. Mm. And I think there are some hard questions to be asked about ANC voters in particular as to how it is they can continue to endorse a party that literally does not have their interests at heart.
Mm.
And increasingly over time has come to harm them and their prospects more than help them. But that is a conversation that very few people want to have in South Africa because, you know, the customer's always right and it's a problem.
Yeah. And I think it is, I suppose it sounds kind of abstract and namby-pamby, but I think there is a genuine sense in which the role of the public commentator, of the writer, of the journalist is not just to sort of stand a little bit outside of the corridors of power and look into them with a critical eye, but it's also to stand a little bit outside of the general mainstream and look with a critical eye upon us and what we demand. And I think sort of in terms of public representation at the political level, there's a similar thing playing out with the media. I often hear criticisms of the media and think, well, you know, if it didn't sell, it wouldn't be that way. There's some, obviously editors have a role to play in balancing between what's going to draw readers in and what's going to really enlighten and inform readers through a critical lens. But ultimately, a lot of it is up to ordinary South Africans, them choosing, I think once, you know, when a newspaper carries so many stories about, I don't want to pick out a particular newspaper, but I think we can all think of at least one that has been forced to apologize for publishing like 20 stories about a fake rogue unit off in one of our branches of government. If that doesn't change your diet, or at least change your approach to that newspaper, if you want to keep reading it because you think there's still good people there, then I think part of the problem is you, as a reader, as just as a civil, someone who engages civilly. But I do think that there's a flip side to it. Like, I listen to the radio sometimes when I'm in one of the institute's cars, because it has a radio, and I hear people call into 702 and SAFM in particular, because those are the ones that I listen to, and I do hear dissenting voices. I do hear critical voices, yes. Not just critical of particular personalities, but critical of ideological approaches,
yes.
Approaches that sort of want to lump together people according to their race, for example. And I often hear those callers, those ordinary citizens, get shouted down or kind of suffer a bit of conversational jiu-jitsu and humiliated because they don't have they're not fluent, I think, in radio speak, because they're not comfortable, and the host obviously is. So I do think there's some sense of people feeling cowed or threatened if they do voice genuine yes. concern. And social media is obviously the really obvious platform for that.
Yes. So there are a few points I'd make in response to that. The one is that I certainly agree that readers are responsible in part for the content of a newspaper via the kind of pressure and obviously sales.
Yeah.
I think a good indicator of the decline of public debate are the letters pages in newspapers, which, I mean, I remember reading the Business Day 10, 15 years ago. Really senior, top-notch, you know, private sector individuals, key thinkers, public intellectuals would write letters to that newspaper and engage with it on a day-to-day basis. It still has one of the best letters pages out of those papers out there, but, I mean, as for the bulk of them, there's just rubbish gets published every week. Just sentimental responses, I like this story, I don't like this story, I like this person, I don't like that person. Very little people with original insight or analysis from the public that contribute to newspapers in the place that it can. And letters pages are historically the most read pages in any newspaper. So I think there's a general decline in that relationship and a dumbing down both on the part of the public and the press. The other point I had, which was really excellent, I can't remember anymore.
Well, we'll give you a chance to come back with that one. But I think I'd like you to talk a bit to how – so, you know, you've got these editors, you've got these gatekeepers in the traditional media and producers and hosts on radio shows and producers on TV yeah. shows and anchors. But one of the things that's changed fundamentally sort of since between Mbeki – and now Ramaphosa, in the Zuma era, we've come to know the social media, where those gatekeepers are removed, and there's a different game, there's a different information kind of economy there.
Yes.
There's a different way that things get traded out. Do you see hope there? Do you see it as more of the same kind of moral weather veining?
Well, look, I don't know if this is going to answer your question, but one thing I think has happened to the columnist in South Africa. Now, there's no standard way to be a columnist. It's a subjective exercise, and you can bring your own style and, you know, narrative to how you approach a column. But I think that there is a kind of uniformity to them these days. Generally, what has happened is the rise of the personality as columnist. And in order to understand the world, they experience it and explain it and write about it as it happens to them. So it is politics as personal. I went to the shop and someone looked at me askew, and so here are my thoughts on racism. Or I had an experience here, or I like this person, and therefore I think this about them. The word I is fairly central to almost all of these columns. And that's fine. You need people like that. You need a diversity of views. My problem is that it seems, you know, ubiquitous across the board, and almost all columnists do this. There aren't enough people who are analyzing the world objectively, who try to remove themselves and their experience from the world and to give their personal opinion, but to comment on the external universe and the things that shape it, as opposed to how they experience it I mean, look, you can never remove yourself from a column. It's your experience and it's a subjective one. But the emphasis doesn't seem to be on understanding anything outside of their own personal experience.
Mm.
And I think that leads to very bad analysis often. You downplay the importance of evidence and data and objectivity. And you lose some compassion for other people's viewpoints and understanding of the world.
Mm, mm. And I think, yeah, you wrote nicely in this column, and it's sort of a line that runs through sort of this us-them thinking kind of way of doing things. And I think when you identify very strongly, when you don't have any ironic distance between your analysis and your
yes.
and your person, your ego, your I, then it's quite hard to not see any criticism as a personal attack and therefore kind of as inherently flawed because I am great and anyone who disagrees yes. with me is great. So there's this us-them thinking, but there's also this I-them thinking where it's like I'm perfectly correct, I can't be changed.
That is a very important point. So how that manifests is a columnist will be attacked or a column will be attacked. And because they have so fundamentally infused their personality with their worldview, they interpret it, as you say, as an attack on them.
Mm.
And so you then get a series of columns defending themselves, and it boils down to a personal exchange. Whereas, and this is just my view, this isn't the right way to do it, but this is the kind of thing I think you need more balance in society this way, is if you write a column and people hate it, you should, unless it's defamatory or palpably wrong in some effect, take the hit.
Mm.
Your point is to put an argument out there and make people think.
Mm.
And if people get angry in response, that's a natural good response.
Mm.
You shouldn't then be so invested in it that it then becomes about defending who you are as a person.
Mm.
And your general inclination should be to move on and say something else that makes someone else think.
Yes, to go get on to the next thing. And I think someone was saying to me the other day, there's an interesting quality to that pain or that sense of anger that people get when they confront ideas that they don't like, which is that we often remember things much better when we have a strong affective emotional state at the same time. So sort of when I read something that conflicts strongly with my analysis because there's new data and it kind of embarrasses me, it's like, it feels kind of bad, but then that feeling goes, sort of helps my brain remember that fact and assimilate that fact and integrate that yes. fact into a new and sort of better way of thinking. And I think you were writing on Twitter the other day sort of about how debates in South Africa never seems to be about changing your mind, but rather about...
Yes. Yes, I don't think, and I mean, it's the other problem you have, of course, is that a lot of these personalities who have these substantial columns also work in other mediums. Mm. They have television shows or radio shows. And, you know, radio and television is quite different from a newspaper column. A newspaper column is your personal space that you can use how you want. But when, especially on public radio, your job is to describe the world, to provide some analysis of it, but, you know, in terms of your interaction with it as opposed to your moral judgment of it.
Mm.
And I think what happens is those radio and television shows become a bit like these personal columns. And so this is your earlier point. If someone phones in, presenters feel it's their job to morally judge their view from their framework.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, if they say something wrong, be corrected, or if you have a different analysis, offer it up. But I think it should all be done in the spirit of trying to better understand the world out there rather than trying to make the world subscribe to your view.
Mm. Mm. Would that it were easy to tune into that kind of show every day. Maybe we'll start a radio show, yes. See if we can set the tone. Okay, I think that... There's something I just want to say. I want you to speak to two more things from that piece. One is this: you the builder breaker distinction. So you write that in the Nationalist Party's day, they got to the point where they said there are two kinds of people: they're builders, and then there's breakers.
Yes.
And the great irony is that they were breakers at a catastrophic level. They just really were foolish, wicked, incompetent, and when they were competent, often incompetently doing exactly the wrong thing, breaking the fabric of society.
Yes.
And breaking people all too literally. Why isn't that something that we can come to grips with, that way of thinking that you're either a builder or a breaker, that you're either an optimist or you're a traitor. Why is it so hard? One would think that we've gone through so many changes that that would change too.
Yes.
And yet it seems like a resilient undercurrent in South African sort of political discourse at a level that goes beyond just these gatekeepers.
Well, look, there's quite a complex answer to that question. The first one is to say, almost as a disclaimer, that patriotism can be a very good idea in a society, obviously depending on what it is underpinned by. If it is ideas of the good citizen, a healthy civil society, a kind of robust, you know, constitutional democracy, and fighting for those things as they manifest in your country, that's a healthy thing to engender in people, a sense of pride in the kind of values that we have as a society, if they're good values. The problem when patriotism becomes dangerous is when it's put in the hands of nationalists. Because nationalists see themselves as primary, they don't see the country as primary. That quote from Zuma in 1996, I think it was, where he said the ANC is more important than the Constitution, is one of the most important quotes, I think, in South African modern political history. Zuma was brilliant at being able to articulate the ANC's base impulses, which through discipline and a better sort of rational grasp of what's manageable in the marketplace of ideas, they suppressed to a large extent. But he and his acolytes often gave very explicit articulation to these kind of impulses. And that one is critical because from the ANC's conception, or people within, you know, similar to Zuma within the ANC, in their conception, the ANC comes first, it gives birth to the Constitution, it gives birth to South Africa, it is the new South Africa. And so their idea of what patriotism is intricately linked with who they are. They believe they are the country's best interests, and naturally whatever decision they make is in the interests of the people. And that's when this idea starts to become warped and dangerous. And nationalists also have this huge impulse for us and them thinking. It's intrinsic to nationalism, by its very nature. And so, obviously, if you're not on board their particular vision and view for the country, then you are a breaker, because they are intrinsically builders. And so, I mean, builder and breaker is just one iteration of these ideas, but there are 100 ways in which a nationalistic organization that cannot separate itself from a country will define people as us and them, using patriotism as the catch to do that. I mean, there's a long list of people that the ANC has called treasonous. Everyone from Desmond Tutu to Tony Leon. And treason, you know, is a crime punishable by death in a lot of countries. It's not a joke slur to throw around. But the ANC does it mostly to people that oppose what it stands for, as opposed to people who believe they are fighting for what the country stands for, and that happens to require them opposing the ANC on this issue.
Okay, I don't know. I think that is a genuinely, it's big picture, and yeah, I like it because it gets past just the picture of the particular political actors to kind of, I think, spirits and inclinations that are in all of us, and that in a lot of South African citizens have again and again, I think, won out over reason, won out over the classically liberal kind of valuation of individual free thought, free speech around that thought, and of a project that, insofar as it is a collective project, is really a collection of individuals all pulling in their own ways, rather than sort of being yoked, spanned in together, and driving in a uniform direction. Gareth, I think this is your last day in these offices. I hope we're going to have you back.
I'm sure you will.
I'm sure we will. Is there anything else you want to talk to?
Well, 1,000 things, but nothing that immediately comes to mind as urgent.
Okay, nothing just now. Well, when they do come to your mind and when they come to ours, we're gonna have to find ways to rope you back in to the Daily Friend Show. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And looking forward to it. And I don't know, to finish with a fun fact, it's the 28th of June, exactly 101 years ago, I think one of the most infamous political documents was signed, the Treaty of Versailles, and it changed history in interesting ways. And Nicholas Lorimer and I are going to be talking about that on a podcast later today. And yeah, check out the writing on the Daily Friend website, and keep reading Gareth's column in Business Day. I think it's an exemplar for a different way of approaching this country, and really, I think even more deeply than that, of approaching the problem of being a human being, the human condition. It's difficult, it's complicated, and it's best done with both eyes open. So that's it for me. Thank you very much. Bueno.
Thanks, man.